Yeah, microphone. You would hear me, but those who are watching online might not hear me without microphone. So therefore, we use these technical equipments. Are we on now? Okay, good. So, once again, welcome to this afternoon session, small seminar in Education for All movement to celebrate and to publish the global monitoring report produced by UNESCO around Education for All process. These reports have been published. Well, we will hear about it from Joanna soon, but many, many pieces already since the process started in the beginning of this century. And we are very happy that so many of you have arrived here, and we are extremely happy to get Dr. Joanna Härmä from the UNESCO headquarters, Paris, to present the report today. And the launch of the global launch of this report is also at the same minutes now in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia, taking place there. So we are sharing this honor to be on the same line at the same time. And Jyväskylä, University of Jyväskylä is happy to host this occasion and opportunity. First, we will hear some welcoming notes, speeches, and we will start with Professor Kari Pitkänen, who is the head of the Department of Strategic Planning of the University. Kari, welcome. Yes.
Ladies and gentlemen, when I came to this university from the University of Helsinki in 2007, they were still renovating this old main building of the old 19th century teacher training seminar of Jyväskylä. And then when they completed renovation, I came here for the first event and I saw this nice speakers stand, and I always wanted to give a speech from here. Well, I won't give you a speech this time either, but at least I am going to welcome you all to this event we are having today when we are launching the UNESCO Global Monitoring Report. As we heard, the international launching of the report is going on in Ethiopia, in Addis Ababa. And this event is a parallel Finnish national launching event. And we have organized this in collaboration with the Ministry of Education and Culture and the Ministry of Foreign Affairs of Finland. I'm truly very pleased that the University of Jyväskylä can host the launching event. Education is one of the main core fields of this university, and there are not very many Finnish universities that can say the same thing. As the UNESCO report that we will hear in more detail later on indisputably shows providing education, and in particular providing quality education for all, is pivotal for development in present day world. When I was a young researcher, many decades ago, actually in the 1980s, I was teaching my own field in social sciences, sociology or demography in particular. And I gave lectures on global fertility patterns, global fertility trends. And in the 1980s, we still had very many countries that had very high fertility levels, one of them being India. India, back in those days, still had very high fertility levels, and also population growth was very, very rapid. But there was one exception, a province of Kerala, one not so large province in the country. They had decreasing, quite rapidly decreasing fertility levels. And of course, I wanted to explain my students what was going on in that part of India. And I tried to research literature reports. And of course, there are always many things that affect trends and changes. But one of the key factors in affecting fertility trends in Kerala was education. The provincial government tried to ensure that Kerala was able to provide education for all. And when they said education for all, they actually meant it. And that also meant that they tried to include girls as well. They tried to make sure that also girls had a chance to go to school and get education. And in a slightly longer run, that had an effect. Women became empowered in negotiations with their husbands, men, and they were able to aim at smaller family sizes. And that shows the power of education. But sadly enough, as we can see from the report, there are millions and millions of children in many parts of the world who do not even today have a chance to get proper quality education. The report also, as much as I have been able to see, focuses on teachers and on teacher education. And again, remembering my own past, I was very actively involved in international education trade union activities in the mid-1990s. And I became aware of the situation of teachers in the countries of the world. Even back then, we were not that well known because of our PISA success. But still, our teachers here were very privileged. Compared to many other countries, our teachers had a very good education. They were valued. But in many countries of the world, teacher education was quite poor. Teachers were not valued a lot. And that's why it's sometimes difficult to get motivated people to teacher training. And in the worst cases, teachers become victims of political movements, political unrest. And in the worst cases, they are even persecuted. Because even political movements know that providing education to people empowers them. And that's why there are groups that do not want to see people being empowered by education. But all my experience from the past has helped me to understand how imperative it is to be able to provide education for all. And this is why, coming back to where I started, I'm so very glad that my university here in Jyväskylä is able to host this meeting and also have this parallel launching event of the report. I hope, well, I'm actually quite sure, looking at the program, that you all will have a very fruitful and interesting event seminar this afternoon. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Professor Kari. And then we continue. Our Dean, Professor Maria-Leena Laakso, on behalf of the Faculty of Education.
Ladies and gentlemen, participants of this UNESCO Global Monitoring Report launch event. On behalf of the Faculty of Education, it is my great pleasure to welcome you all to attend this very topical and important event. Especially, I want to welcome our visitor from the Global Monitor Report team, Dr. Joanna Härmä from UNESCO. We very much appreciate that you could arrange to travel this far to attend this seminar. The theme of this seminar is crucially important as it highlights that education should be everyone's civil right, unrelated to social class, place of residence or gender. I also see that the theme of the seminar is very important and also very current to our university and especially to the Faculty of Education. Last year, our university celebrated its 115th anniversary. Namely, in 1863, a priest and a scholar, Uno Signaus, founded the first Finnish medium teacher training college, Jyväskylä Teacher Seminary. Since that time, the Faculty of Education has received great success in educating teachers ranging from early childhood education through primary school and subject teacher training to adult education. The faculty scope also includes training for special need teachers, school study counselors, and educational leadership experts. Uno Signaus was ahead of his time, since already then he firmly emphasized that education belongs to all citizens, regardless of their social class, gender, or any other circumstance. At his initiative, Finnish women were accepted to this new teacher training college. Before that time, scholars here in Finland had, amongst other things, claimed that women's nervous system and brain functions could not tolerate the pressures that attending high-level education would cause. At present, these kinds of arguments sound unbelievable and even funny, and it's hard to imagine any reason why we should segregate or give different rights for different people relating to education. However, the UNESCO Global Monitoring Report clearly shows that worldwide, we are far from achieving this education for all goal, even today. Right this moment, as Kari Pitkänen already mentioned, there are many countries and millions of boys and girls who still fail to learn because they are not allowed to go to school for one reason or another. So there is much work to do. One issue that was raised in this 11th Global Monitoring Report was that the education system is only as good as it teaches. Behind this statement, there is much evidence that education quality improves when teachers are supported and when they have good qualifications themselves. As we know, Finland is famous for having high-quality teacher education system and highly educated teachers in all levels. Interestingly, however, just last week, I, together with my colleagues, wrote a statement to our policymakers to express our worries relating to governmental plan to downgrade the competence requirements of our kindergarten teachers. So, even in our country, appreciating high standard in education can't be regarded as self-evident. We who work in this field see that education is always an investment for future, not a cost. And furthermore, as this seminar also indicates, there is strong vision that the countries who have made success in the field of education should not only further develop their own education and schooling systems, but also work even harder in international educational cooperation. In the spirit of the sentence, pay it forward. With these words, I wish you all a very rewarding seminar day. Thank you.
Thank you, Professor Marilena. And it's time to go forward with our program. I don't see Professor Päivi here. She did not announce any hindrance, but so we just go forward. And next, we go to the business itself, to the Global Monitoring Report, and Dr. Joanna. Warmly welcome to give the presentation of the report of this year. Do you want this mic or?
That's just for the live streaming. Okay. So, hello, everybody. You all know already. I'm Joanna Harma from the UNESCO Global Monitoring Report team. I've been with the report team now for just over 2 years, and before that, I was working on the other side in Nigeria, working with the government there to improve their education data. So the data that gets fed through into the report, I was working with them to help improve. And I just want to start with a few words on the Education for All movement, for maybe some of you who aren't so familiar with it. It's a global movement that was started back in 2000 in Dakar in Senegal. And 6 Education for All goals were agreed by 164 countries, with 2015 as the deadline for achieving those goals. And every year since 2002, the Education for All Global Monitoring Report has charted the progress towards these goals. And this year's report, because it's the last chance to really get some influence, hopefully, on the post-2015 agenda, we also look at issues going forward, past the deadline for these goals, to talk about things that really need to be addressed in the next set of goals. every year's report has a particular theme of great relevance and importance. And this year's theme is the global learning crisis and the role specifically that teachers play in solving this crisis and ensuring learning for all, especially for the most disadvantaged and the most marginalized, who are always the focus of our reports. I'll start with some key messages from the report. We can now say for sure that by 2015, many countries will still not have reached the goals. Despite some progress, too many children are still out of school, and the number of illiterate adults has remained almost unchanged. So we can say for sure that, unfortunately, the goals will not be reached. There's a global learning crisis that is hitting the disadvantaged the hardest. It's not enough to simply go to school, which many children do, but they have to also learn when they're in the classroom. And 4 in 10 children of primary school age are not learning the basics, whether they are in school or out of school. And this is hitting the disadvantaged the hardest. That's including girls, those living in remote rural areas, those suffering from disabilities, and those in conflict-affected countries. Good quality education clearly cannot be achieved without good quality teachers. So policymakers need to ensure that there are sufficient teachers of good quality who have had appropriate training and are able to support the learning of the most disadvantaged. And looking at the post-2015 agenda, the next set of education goals must track the progress of the marginalized specifically. Failure to reach the disadvantaged has to be remedied by putting equity at the heart of the next set of goals to make sure that all young people, irrespective of their background and where they live, are learning and in school. There must be clear targets the progress towards which can be measured using a set of agreed upon indicators. And specifically, we would like to see these goals tracking the progress of the disadvantaged and the gap between them and their more advantaged peers, hoping that this gap is going to get smaller and smaller and eventually disappear, hopefully by 2030. The post-2015 goals must also include specific targets on finance for all governments to make sure that no one is left behind due to a lack of resources, which was actually one of the original promises in 2000, but we still have not seen a fulfillment of that promise. And now I'll begin the monitoring part of the presentation, just talking about some progress towards 5 of the 6 goals. The 6th goal is covered in more detail in the second half of the presentation, which basically focuses on goal 6, the quality of education. So with respect to the first goal for expanding access to early childhood care and education, despite improvements, far too many children still lack any kind of early childhood care and education. 1 in 4 children under 5 suffer from stunting because of malnutrition. And between 1999 and 2011, the pre-primary gross enrollment ratio has increased from 33% to 50%. However, it has still only reached 17% in low-income countries. With regard to universal primary education, this target is going to be missed by quite a large margin. 57 million children are out of school, half of whom live in conflict-affected countries, though the number of out-of-school children has fallen by 47%, so quite good progress between 1999 and 2011. But in sub-Saharan Africa, only 23% of poor rural girls complete a primary education. With regard to providing youth and adults with appropriate education and skills training, many adolescents lack the foundation skills that would be gained through a lower secondary education at the least. Even though participation at the lower secondary level has increased from 72% to 82%, still 69 million adolescents are out of school. And in low-income countries, only 37% of adolescents complete their lower secondary education, and only 14% of the very poorest people. Now, this graph will show that the number of primary school-age children has fallen quite dramatically since 1999, although the progress has slowed quite badly since 2008. But what is worse is the number of out-of-school adolescents. Again, progress started well but has leveled off, and the progress has generally been slower. And in sub-Saharan Africa, the number of out-of-school adolescents has remained totally unchanged since 1999 because increasing enrollment has not kept up with population growth. There is a very long way to go for achieving the 50% reduction in adult illiteracy. The adult literacy rate has increased from 76% in 1990 to 84% in 2011, but there are still 774 million illiterate adults, a decline of just 1% since 2000, and almost two-thirds of these illiterate adults are women. Gender disparities still remain in many countries. There are fewer than 9 girls for every 10 boys enrolled in 17 countries at the primary level and 30 countries at the secondary level. And that's just parity in enrollment. With regard to absolute equality in all levels of education, that goal is even more elusive. So this graph shows that the analysis for this year's report, which identifies how many countries are actually likely to reach the 5 of the 6 goals here, the first goal of early childhood care and education is expected to be reached with 80% of children enrolled at that level by 48% of countries. Universal primary education is expected to be reached by 56% of countries. And not such good progress for achieving lower secondary education with 46% of countries. Adult literacy is by far the goal that is the most off track, as I already hinted at, with only 29% of countries expected to reach the goal. Gender parity at the primary level in enrollments is the goal expected to have got the most progress, with 70% of countries achieving the goal, but only 56% of countries achieving gender parity at the lower secondary level. Insufficient progress towards education goals reveals a failure to reach the most marginalized. And the new global education goals after 2015 must therefore galvanize special efforts to ensure that all children are in school and learning. In sub-Saharan Africa, on recent rates of progress, all of the richest boys in the continent will be completing primary schooling by 2021. They will all be completing lower secondary by 2041. But for the poorest girls, they will only complete primary school by 2086 on current trends, and will complete lower secondary school by a whopping 2111. This failure can only be remedied by having equity at the heart of the post-2015 agenda. As I said before, with clear targets, with indicators that can measure progress, tracking this gap between the most advantaged and the most disadvantaged to make sure that this gap disappears. Finance is absolutely vital to achieving the goals. And there is an annual finance gap now of $26 billion per year for basic education. And domestic resources are by far the most important source of finance, but the poorest countries do require aid. But for the first time since 2002, aid to basic education has actually dropped by 6% between 2010 and 2011. And low-income countries have been particularly affected. They receive only $1.9 billion for basic education, and 19 of these countries have actually experienced a reduction in their funding between 2010 and 2011. So aid is now reaching the most disadvantaged, less than it was before. After 2015, we must make sure that no one is left behind just because of lack of resources. So financing targets need to be set for countries to allocate at least 6% of their GNP on education. Only 41 countries had reached that level by 2011. And we recommend that at least 20% of the government budget should be spent on education, and only 25 countries had reached that level by 2011. Financing targets should also apply to aid donors so that all funders are held to account for their promises. This is now a slight change in pace to the thematic part of the report. So this is where we talk in great depth about education quality and the role that teachers have. The report is called Teaching and Learning, Achieving Equity for All. And it basically talks about the global learning crisis and what policymakers need to do to help support teachers to solve this crisis. The crisis is hitting the disadvantaged the hardest, as I've already indicated. 250 million children are not learning the basics, which is equivalent to 38% of all children of primary school age in the world. 130 million of these children are unable to read, write, or do basic mathematics, despite having spent 4 years in primary school. The other 120 million have not even had the 4 years in primary school. And the majority of these children not learning live in poor countries and usually come from more disadvantaged backgrounds. The poor, girls, those living in remote rural areas, and children suffering from disabilities. Often unable to read a simple sentence, these children are ill-equipped to make any kind of transition to lower secondary school, and most will not make it to that level. There are enormous regional differences between continents, between areas, in terms of this learning crisis. In North America and Western Europe, 96% of children do stay in school until grade 4 and manage to achieve the basic reading standards. But this is only 1/3 in South and West Asia, and only 2/5 in Sub-Saharan Africa. And these regions account for more than 3/4 of those not crossing these minimum learning thresholds. In 21 of the 85 countries for which we have full data, less than half of children are learning the basics. Of these, 17 countries are in Sub-Saharan Africa. And if children are failing to learn the basics while they're in school, this increases their risk of dropout, and it means that disadvantage will remain and become possibly even greater over time. Insufficient spending on education is a false economy. It's creating a learning crisis that has costs not only for the ambitions of children, but also for the current finances of government. Because the annual cost of children who are in school and still failing to learn the basics is equivalent to $129 billion, or 10% of global spending on primary education. And the scale of the learning crisis is large, It has huge variation between continents, but it also has huge variations within countries. So these are the data points for the poor and for the rich. This graph shows that whether a child is learning is strongly influenced by family wealth. It includes children, this graph includes information on all children, whether they are in school or not. In many African countries, no more than 1 in 5 poor children reach the last grade and learn the basics, the last grade of primary. And in Latin America, where performance is generally higher, children from disadvantaged backgrounds lag behind still. For example, in El Salvador, half of the number of children from the poorest households complete a primary education and master the basics compared with their richer peers. But even in rich countries, of course, there are still marginalized subpopulations. For example, in Australia, 2/3 of indigenous students reach the minimum benchmarks at grade 8, but it's about 90% of their non-indigenous peers. But it is possible, it has been shown as being possible, to increase access and get more children into school while still achieving learning. Tanzania has made great strides since the fee abolition in 2001, and between 2000 and 2007, around 1.5 million additional children have been shown to actually be learning the basics, despite this huge increase in access as well. 1/4 of those young people aged 15 to 24 in poor countries are unable to read a single sentence. 175 million young people in low and lower middle income countries are unable to read. That's 25% of young people in low and middle income countries being illiterate. 40% of young people in sub-Saharan Africa are illiterate. And despite considerable advances in girls' education, a generation of young women is still being left behind, with 61% of illiterate youth being female, while in South and West Asia, it's even higher. It's 2/3 of illiterate young women being, of illiterate youth being women. So we really need to galvanize special efforts to ensure that all children will be learning going forward from here. And of course, teachers are a vital part of the solution of this learning crisis. And our report identifies 4 key strategies to provide the best teachers to reach all children. We need to recruit the best candidates from as wide a range of backgrounds as possible. We need to train them well, both before they enter the classroom as teachers and on an ongoing basis through their careers. And we need to allocate teachers effectively by offering incentives to teach in unattractive places, disadvantaged areas. And we need to retain teachers by improving working conditions and providing an actual career path that makes teachers feel that they have a career that's advancing and progressing. So to start with our first strategy, looking at recruiting the best candidates into teaching, that's something that's, of course, very familiar for everybody in Finland. Teaching is a high-status profession, but in most places, it isn't. And so there needs to be a way of recruiting more high-caliber candidates to reduce the number of pupils per teacher, but also to reduce the number of pupils per trained and qualified teacher. So every year, we need an additional 3.7 million teachers. Sorry, by 2015, we need which is next year, 3.7 million teachers to replace those leaving the profession due to retirements, ill health, change of career. But we also need an additional 1.6 million teachers to achieve universal primary school by 2015. And at current rates of recruitment, 29 countries will not even be able to fill this gap by 2030. In sub-Saharan Africa, the region accounts for 60% of the additional teachers needed, and 9 out of 10 countries needing the most additional primary teachers come from this, from this region, the one exception being Pakistan. And Nigeria has by far the largest gap to fill. So our report this year recommends that policymakers must try to attract these best candidates. All trainees need, at a minimum, to have a complete and good quality secondary education in which those candidates got good grades. They need to have a sound knowledge of the subject that they will be teaching, with the ability to learn and acquire skills that are needed to teach that subject well. There should be a good balance of male and female teachers. Too few female teachers can have adverse consequences for girls' learning opportunities, especially in places like India and Pakistan. In South Sudan, less than 10% of teachers are women, and the government is trying to remedy this situation by offering incentives for girls to finish their secondary education and for young women to then enter the teaching profession. We also very much need teachers from a diverse range of backgrounds to enter the profession. People from different ethnic, religious, linguistic backgrounds and those with disabilities. And we also need to try to recruit teachers from underrepresented groups to work in their own communities to make sure that children have teachers that understand their own culture. In Cambodia, they have been making great efforts in that direction, diversifying recruitment by increasing the pool of teachers from ethnic minorities. And in Mozambique, by using scholarships and well-trained teachers using appropriate facilities, they have managed to support the training of visually impaired primary school teachers. So, for our next strategy, training teachers well, all teachers need training. In one out of three countries, less than three quarters of teachers are trained to the national standard. There is a very large gap often between the pupil-teacher ratio and the pupil-per-trained teacher ratio, as this graph shows. Bangladesh, for example, meets the blanket standard of a pupil-teacher ratio of 40 to 1, but if you take their pupil-per-trained teacher ratio, this rises to 60 to 1. Teachers need to be trained well before and also throughout their career. Mali has recruited teachers very fast over the past decade in order to get children into school and to lower the pupil-teacher ratio dramatically. But many of these teachers are untrained, and the result is that they have a ratio of 92 pupils for every trained teacher, which is one of the highest in the world. And on current trends, Mali will not manage to achieve 40 pupils per trained teacher until 2030. So our recommendation: provide good pre-service and ongoing teacher education. Teachers must have good subject knowledge. In low-income countries, teachers often lack the core subject knowledge because their own education in school was very poor. So in Ghana, they're trying to remedy this by making trainee teachers pass an examination in the subject knowledge in order to graduate from their first year to their second year of teacher training. Teachers must be equipped to meet the needs of the most disadvantaged children, including those in remote and very under-resourced settings. In many contexts, this means multi-grade teaching, so in sparsely populated rural areas, multi-grade teaching is a reality. And where teachers are trained properly for this, it doesn't have to be a problem. So in Sri Lanka, trained teachers have managed to develop lesson plans and grade appropriate tasks for multi-grade settings, and it's had a really positive impact on pupils' learning in maths. Teachers need training in the use of assessment tools to help detect and address learning difficulties early. In Egypt and Liberia, for example, training teachers in early grades reading instruction and the use of linked classroom assessment tools has had a really positive impact on children's learning. This is in contexts where teachers haven't had an extensive pre-service training. teacher trainees should also have classroom experience. This seems obvious, but they should have classroom experience, and new teachers should have the support of trained mentors through the beginning of their career. Learning by doing is, of course, essential. And in Malawi, some training institutes have been doing this. They have been providing ample time for school-based experience for their trainees, including introducing them to the hardships and the realities of living and teaching in rural areas. And of course, the training must not stop once the teacher has entered the classroom. There are always new ideas, new techniques that teachers can learn. And in Jordan, ongoing subject-based professional development programs have been helping some teachers to move away from earlier rote learning methods, which are so common in developing countries. Teacher educators need training too. This is something that is very often forgotten, especially in developing countries. Most teacher educators have very little concrete knowledge and experience of the real classroom situations that their trainees face and the under-resourced settings in which they're teaching. So often the teacher education is divorced from the real world. So teacher educators very much need training too. The next strategy is to allocate teachers well. Without better allocation of teachers, fewer teachers will teach by choice in deprived and remote and rural, difficult to reach areas. Disadvantaged children are often taught by teachers with weaker subject knowledge, exacerbating these inequalities in learning outcomes. And students will often leave school then without having learned the basics. So there are four key areas that we identified where allocation becomes a problem. There is almost always an urban bias. People would like to live in urban centers where there are good facilities for living in general. Malawi has a very bad teacher shortage in general, with a national average of 76 pupils per teacher. But this is made so many times worse by inefficient allocation of the teachers. So there are schools in urban areas where there's an actual surplus of teachers, while in rural areas there can be a real shortage with 150 children to a teacher. Ethnicity and language also leads to unfair or inefficient teacher allocation. In Mexico, it has been found that children who speak indigenous languages are usually or often taught by teachers who have less education and less training. Gender is also a major factor in many countries. For example, in Rwanda, in some areas, only 10% of primary school teachers are women, whereas in other parts of the country, 67% are women. So we need to have ways of evening that out. Subject areas are also an area for inappropriate allocation of teachers, particularly more at the secondary level. In Indonesia, for example, they have an excess of language teachers and a shortage of computer science teachers. So our recommendations is that policymakers should allocate the best teachers where they are actually needed the most. One reason for the Republic of Korea's strong progress has been that the disadvantaged have better access to more qualified and experienced teachers than in many countries. Teachers should be provided with specific incentives to work in remote areas. In Bangladesh, for example, they have been providing safe housing to encourage women to locate to rural areas. In Gambia, they provide a financial incentive of up to 40% of the base salary to work in a remote area. In Rwanda, they offer trained teachers subsidized loans. And in China, high-performing university students are offered incentives such as free tuition for their university studies to teach in rural areas and particularly in their home provinces. And local recruitment of teachers can help to ensure sufficient teachers are working in these difficult and disadvantaged areas, as they have been doing in the case of Lesotho. Local recruitment can also help to get female teachers into schools, although there are certain countries, such as Afghanistan, who's struggling with this problem right now, where many local areas simply lack sufficient numbers of qualified or sufficiently educated people to become teachers. And that country is struggling to address that problem now. So our next strategy was to provide incentives to retain good teachers in the profession. Salaries are a major factor, of course, in people's lives. They're a key consideration for attracting the best candidates and retaining the best teachers. And this graph shows the daily wage of teachers in many countries in dollar terms. A teacher who's the main breadwinner for the family, who has up to four dependent family members, needs to earn at least $10 per day to keep above the minimum poverty line of $2 a day per person. However, in eight countries, teachers are paid below this. And for example, in Liberia, a teacher is only paid $6 per day. But in many places, the situation is even worse. For example, in West Africa, they have been building up the teacher force largely through short-term contract teachers, so not on the usual civil service contract. And in some countries, such as in Senegal, such contract teachers make up almost half of the teaching force. They're usually paid considerably less than the civil service teachers. In Niger, for example, they earn about half as much as their civil service peers. But this can really only be a short-term solution, because usually the contract teachers get together and start demanding that they should be given the same equal pay and working conditions as their civil service peers, as has happened in Benin. So it's only a short-term solution. So we recommend that the correct incentive should be given to attract and retain teachers in the profession. Teachers should be paid enough to meet at least their basic needs and offered the best possible working conditions. Some places have been experimenting with performance-related pay, so if your children are learning more, then you get paid more. But it's extremely difficult to reliably measure the relationship between what one teacher is doing and the learning of the child. So even in systems like the United States, they're struggling to get that right. And it can also end up rewarding teachers who are already working in advantaged settings with high achieving pupils. It also carries the risk of teaching to the test and even reducing cooperation between teachers. So potentially a more practical solution is to give school-wide bonuses, as they've been trying in parts of Brazil. But teachers also need a career path. In many countries, the career path doesn't exist. It's just you're a teacher in a school for the rest of your life with some incremental pay rises. In Ghana, for example, they've been trying. They have instituted a teacher management policy that now allows for evidence-based promotion. In many countries, not here, but in many countries, teacher governance and management is a problem. So we need strong leadership, and unfortunately, much more accountability is needed for teachers. And we need to take measures to tackle some serious teacher misconduct that does take place. For example, tackling gender-based violence that is quite common in many places. Governments need to work very closely with the teacher unions to formulate policies and adopt effective codes of conduct to prevent gender-based misconduct, as has been happening in Kenya. They've been trying to tackle that through agreement on policy. There also needs to be ways to tackle teacher absenteeism, which is very common in many places. It can have huge impacts on student learning, so we need to make sure that teachers are in school. But any policy to address this really needs to address the root cause of the problem, such as erratic teacher pay and poor working conditions. In Cambodia, for example, when teachers did not have to miss school simply to collect their pay every month, then there were many fewer teacher absences. And in Malawi and Zambia, teacher absences due to HIV and AIDS have been reduced through providing better living conditions for HIV-positive teachers and getting better access to treatments, nutritional supplements, and monthly allowances or loans. We also need to prevent teachers from offering private tuition to their own school day pupils. Private tuition is resulting in a widening of inequality in learning based on a family's ability to pay for it or not. In Egypt, private tuition averages over 40% of household spending on education because teachers basically need to find a way to supplement their very poor salaries. And while a complete ban on private tuition is very difficult to enforce, we really do need to stop teachers from giving their own students private tuition to ensure that the full curriculum is taught to all students, irrespective of whether or not they can pay. We also need to have appropriate curriculum and assessment strategies which can support teachers, particularly the great number of teachers that are already out there doing the work but who haven't benefited from good school education themselves and good training. So we need to support learning from the earliest years with curriculum that is delivered at an appropriate pace. And in Vietnam, they've been somewhat more successful, having a curriculum that's closely matched to what children are able to learn and what teachers are able to teach, paying particular attention to disadvantaged learners. We need to provide education in relevant languages. It's been found that bilingual curriculum delivery, where they start and continue with a local language and introduce a second language, is much more successful than trying to start from a colonial language or a national language from the very beginning. Preferably, these two languages should at least continue side by side through the primary level. This can really improve the outcomes for ethnic and linguistic minorities. In Cameroon, they have tried it with having the local language in the early grades, not even all the way through primary school, but just in the early grades, and those children have achieved much higher test scores than those that have been taught exclusively in English from the beginning. And we need to promote inclusion through the curriculum to empower students from disadvantaged backgrounds and to empower female learners. For example, in Honduras, a program to empower girls from minority groups using an interdisciplinary curriculum resulted in many broader positive outcomes, including greater problem-solving skills, greater gender awareness, greater self-confidence, and also, crucially, the test scores. We also need to ensure that we keep a parallel focus on accelerated second chance programs, because many children have already dropped out. They have missed their chance at having what we would consider the normal path through the primary education and beyond. So in countries where there's a high concentration of out-of-school children and youth, second chance and accelerated programs are very important. And in countries where they have been doing this, like in Bangladesh, Ghana, and Liberia, children who have been in these accelerated programs have had learning gains to get them up to the level where they should be so that they can enter back into the formal schooling system. And of great importance, something that's done very well here in Finland, is the need to identify and support low achievers in the classroom. So many teachers in many different countries know only to repeat what they said before in the same way and don't know how to assess when a child is not understanding and why that child is not understanding, and they're not equipped with the various approaches to the same point to try and get that understanding. So in these cases where teachers have not been well trained from the beginning, classroom-based assessment tools can help them to identify and monitor and support the learning of those at risk of falling behind. These assessments, of course, must be aligned to the national curriculum, the main curriculum, so that teachers' workload is not increased and so that it doesn't diverge them from the main curriculum. In South Africa, they've been using a well-designed set of these assessments with very clear guidelines and also guidelines on how to interpret the results when they use these assessments with the children in the classrooms. And it has really improved reading. And this is specifically with teachers that have not benefited from a good pre-service training and education. And in other settings, going back to the multi-grade setting, which is very often necessary in remote areas, children can even be using self-assessment and self-monitoring using the right tools with teachers that are trained in the right methods, as in the activity-based learning model in Tamil Nadu in India. So finally, just to recap, the main message of this report, the thematic section, is that successful reform really requires governments and policymakers to engage more with teachers. Teachers are often seen as the problem or part of the problem, but they should, of course, be seen as the solution. And it's crucial that teachers and teacher unions are engaged in the design, development, and implementation of policies and reforms to improve education quality for all. And thank you very much for listening to that long presentation. You can join in the conversation online by visiting the website and on Twitter with the hashtag #TeachAndLearn. And I will be very happy to answer questions and discuss.
Thank you, Joanna, very much for this presentation, for those figures, for those visions, for the challenges to be met in this process. Well, there we saw a lot of big figures, ununderstandable millions and billions, and kids out of schools, illiterate kids. Although we also notice improvement in many areas. So without EFA process, the figures probably would look much worse than they are at the moment. So now I open the floor for your questions and comments. What you would like to comment on these programs and these policy strategies and steps to be forward. Onerva, please.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you very much for excellent presentation, also this excellent book. I just glanced through. I might not find the answer for my question, but it might be there. How is education facing your future computerized education and the technical advantages which could be offered all over the world now when all the equipments are getting cheaper, instead of just walking on the old traditional trades? How is this revolution faced? I don't know if this report has it.
So I'll just address that one question first. Yeah, it's something that we really struggled with, especially even in the report of the year before. We were particularly struggling with how do we maintain our report's traditional focus on the most marginalized and the poorest and also address something that you rightly point out is inescapable. It's growing in so many areas of the world, the use of technology in education. As of now, it has been very piecemeal, and I don't think anywhere so far has, in a poor context, been able to work out a way of really harnessing technology. I think probably the most successful use of technology has been in a very old medium of radio instruction, because there are just so many settings now where there is no electricity and there is no one who even knows how to use a computer. So right now I think there's a huge digital divide, and just getting teachers to even be able to teach well with the traditional. But I understand your point. Do we want to just keep going on the same old line of trying to use the old ways, or harness what technology can give us? But I think right now, for reaching the 57 million out of school, for example, and the 250 million not learning, I think technology is probably quite far off in most of those contexts. I mean, for myself, I just imagine driving through miles upon miles, kilometers upon kilometers between villages in rural Nigeria. And right now, I can't see a way that technology can really bring education to those areas where teachers don't. But I guess it's something that we're still grappling with. I don't know if that answered that question at all.
Joo, Jussi.
My name is Jussi Karakoski. I'm education advisor in the Ministry for Foreign Affairs. I think I have two questions. First one is perhaps more a comment or rhetoric question, and the second one is a question. But first, I'd like also to thank Joanna for a very rich presentation, and for the GMR team for, as usual, a very rich report. And I'd like to encourage everybody to go to the web page, because there are very many other materials besides the main report, case studies and infographics and many other very rich sources of information. Also, the theme of the report is very timely, focusing on teaching and learning. I think the one figure I picked up from the presentation, that 10% of global spending on primary education is wasted because there is schooling but not learning taking place, and that's enough of a justification for focusing in this theme. My rhetoric question perhaps is on my first impression, or that there's so much doom and gloom in the report, so many depressingly big figures related to many challenges, global challenges. So the analysis part, for a good reason, gives a very negative picture, and perhaps the positive side is in your messages and recommendations. Arguably, there are two narratives, as Matti was also referring to. There's been marked progress in certain areas in terms of access in some countries, whereas in other countries or other issues like quality of learning, for instance, there's been less progress, and adult literacy and so on and so forth. So in order to incentivize action, perhaps we could think of another way of presenting first the positive narrative and to give it a bit more focus, and then the remaining challenges as the second narrative around education for all. My question is on the if you could elaborate on or quantify why the rate of progress towards EFA goals has been reduced in the past 5 years or so. That's really alarming for the global education community. Do you find evidence in your research in terms of the relative importance of, let's say, proportion of out of schools reducing, that some groups, be it pastoralists or disabled learners or street children, are harder or costlier to reach, or perhaps less of a priority to many countries? What is the relative importance of population growth, cancelling progress? What's the relative importance of changes in national or donor funding, stagnation of funding versus ever-growing population figures, and so on and so forth? Is it possible to somehow give quantitative estimates of relative importance of major factors related to this slowing progress towards the goals? Thank you.
Yeah, I think really there are some key reasons why the progress has slowed down. First, of course, there was the big drive. So in 2000, everybody got excited about education for all. And then in the first few years of the decade, the fee abolitions were taking place in many countries. So many children were entering primary school who just couldn't because of cost. I mean, we all know that there are still costs associated with supposedly fee-free primary education in many places. But first of all, it seemed like the Education for All movement got, I don't know if this saying translates well, but the low-hanging fruits, so the easy children to reach. So all of those that there was just a simple barrier, okay, fees going, fine, we'll go to school, okay. So that got a lot of children, and that's why there's that huge decrease in the out-of-school children. And then in the more recent years, I guess this global financial crisis has been meaning less funding. But there are so many other factors as well. I was involved in 2008 in the design of the British government's replacement program for what had been the existing program in Kenya when there was this huge scandal over waste, embezzling basically the aid money in the multi-donor program for Kenya's education. And I don't know if anybody watched the news this morning, but horrible news is just coming out of Malawi today about the same kind of thing. So millions of dollars in aid money going astray. So when I was there in Kenya, for example, there's this huge divide, just like in Nigeria, between the north of the country, which is, you know, deserts and pastoralists, and then the south of the country, which is the kind of Kenya that you think of with more prosperity. And we were trying to figure out ways to reach pastoralist communities. So these are getting, you know, within the final 10% or the final 20%, the hardest to reach. And there were so many things that you could do. For example, most or many of the pastoralist groups would be traveling for a good part of the year, but every year they have a settled, which I didn't know. It was through this process that I found this out, that even the people that are moving around with their herds, they have a settled period every single year of 4 to 5 months. And that would be the time that you have the settled school for those children following a totally different schedule than the children in the southern half of Kenya that have a more normal sort of routine that we would be used to, and they follow the academic school year. So you could have a more accelerated program that's completely different to reach pastoralist children in the north. But basically, there was a lot of resistance to this kind of thing, and I think a certain amount of arrogance of the majority government, which was more from the southern part of the country, you know, arrogance towards that lifestyle that, you know, why should they get a totally different system? So I think it's a lot of it is that kind of thing as well. So there was a huge progress in getting the easy to reach. And now we have to focus on these very hard to reach. And it's that kind of thing. There's lack of willingness. And then in a lot of these poorest countries, a lot of them are affected by conflict. And I've now worked on a couple of UK government-funded programs. The big one in Nigeria I was working on recently. And there's just a huge donor reluctance to engage in countries where they're unstable, where there's conflict. And so that's, I think, why a lot of the progress has stopped, because the ones that need what we're talking about in this report are in those countries. I mentioned earlier the only 1.9 billion going to the poorest in low-income countries to basic education. So it's the hardest to reach are hardest for their own governments to reach, and they're also not even being reached by aid donors because it's just too difficult of a situation to engage with them. And of course, donors don't want to be wasting their money on governments that are going to waste the money or they feel are not able to operationalize the money well. So I think those are probably the two main things, is that I think it was going to be inevitable that there was a decreasing curve in progress because those easy to reach were easy to reach. Now they're reached, fine, so we have to move on to the hard to reach. And I think that's a combination of the cultural things I was talking about, like not really wanting to address the issues of people with a totally different lifestyle, and just the difficulty of getting money to reach those places in the right way to get those people. So I think those are probably the two biggest factors. But we haven't actually done any analysis as part of the report to say, okay, this is the biggest factor, and then this is the second biggest factor. But that's what comes out, I think, really.
So it is not only an issue of the amount of dollars, but also organizing societies and cultures to invest all the money on most effective way.
Yeah, and I mean, it's a national issue and a donor issue. I mean, northern pastoralist Kenya is a huge, geographical area to try and reach, whereas I was working in Lagos, which, okay, it's a huge city with millions and millions of people, but I was out in a canoe that I rented finding all these tiny little schools, private schools, because the government didn't serve illegal migrants from Benin coming to fish in the Lagos Lagoon, who had to set up their own schools, and the parents were supporting this through paying fees, and the ones who can't afford it, their children are just out of school. And I was telling the Lagos state government that these schools exist on stilts in the water, on the lagoon, and they said, no, there's no schools out there. And I said, I have the photos if you'd like to see them. So yeah, I mean, there's just a certain unwillingness to engage with lifestyles and people who are in illegal settlements as well, so slums and remote areas, big problems. Any questions?
Yeah, Jussi, please.
There are other questions. I have a comment. One thing which I think is a novelty in the report is the focus on tax collection and the figures, which are at least in the summary, not in your presentation, I think those figures are very convincing. I think the donor community, at least the education community, oftentimes focuses too much on the simple figures. What is the percentage of education in the national budget? What is the percentage of education compared to the GDP or GNP? But the capacity of countries to collect tax differs enormously, and you have very convincing figures and arguments there. And I think that should be much, much more a priority for the governments, of course, and it's linked with all the good governance issues and corruption issues and resource curse issues that are discussed quite a bit, but oftentimes the linkage is not made to the sectoral issues. And I think the education community should also for this reason tried to talk more with the Ministry of Finance and tax authorities and so on and so forth. So I think increased attention to that issue is very important, and if whatever the trajectory of international aid will be, this is such different level of scale in terms of overall resources going to education globally that I think without even if we stick to our commitments in terms of ODA as donor countries, we should still focus much more on this issue.
Yes, please.
Thank you very much for the presentation. I think special needs children or disabilities are some of the factors that affect student learning. And you mentioned a lot of categories of children who are excluded, but I didn't hear you mentioning children with disabilities or special needs. Is it not your focus anymore?
Actually, I did mention it quite a few times when saying what we consider the marginalized. I didn't go into it, but I did say children suffering from disabilities, and it's a huge issue. It's very hard for us to write about it because the data is very poor. Every year, we're struggling to find good studies that we can rely on to talk more about the issue. We would love to talk more about it in the report, but it's really hard to get really good data on that. So it's not something that we ignore or give less focus to out of choice. We mention it literally wherever we can, and our team is searching in the office for any kind of reports, and wherever we can, we use household survey data from the parents on children suffering with disabilities. But it's that's about all I can say. For us, it's very important, but it's just something that we find difficult to elaborate on because the report really focuses on evidence, and while we know it's a huge issue, we just don't have good data on it. And that is the sad truth.
Mm-hmm. Yes, please.
Thank you. Kind of going off of the same question, just from the brief parts that I have read of the report, it seems that one of the focuses has been on monitoring and evaluation and the lack of it and the lack of specific criteria that were set for the goals. And like you're saying now, the lack of data about certain goals. And I'm wondering, moving forward from 2015, how do you think that that's going to improve, and what is the commission doing to try to make sure that we have specific criteria and goals and ways to learn about this information?
Yeah, that's a really difficult one. It's something that, as I mentioned in the presentation, that we at UNESCO are pushing for very hard, that there should be a set of indicators, and they should be agreed on, because it's very hard as well to be comparative internationally when everybody's measuring things in different ways. So we would really like to see a set of sort of calm and rational indicators. It's funny because my husband right now is working on a UK government-funded project in India, working on secondary schooling, and they are trying to agree a set of indicators right now. Like, right now they're working on this in cooperation with UNICEF as well. And the set of indicators they're coming out with is like this. I mean, and there is no data to measure those things. So it's a huge holistic thing. You need to have better data collection systems, and then you need to have rational indicators of things that you can measure, because there's no point in having all these things that's going to come back with star, 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 zero data. So I think it's going to be very difficult. There are a lot of national governments, like even in Nigeria, even in India, they tend to think that they can do everything and they can go from 0 to 60 in 1.3 seconds rather than taking a more developmental approach. So a lot of the time they want to set a huge list of indicators when right now Nigeria can't even tell you how many students it has. So it's going to be very difficult to get an agreed list that's small enough but comprehensive enough as well at the same time and for which we can actually get data. But that's something that we are fighting for. I don't know how successful that's going to be, but it's going to require a lot of, I think, international negotiation because I think a lot of the time federal governments or governments at the top level aren't quite aware of, they don't quite think down to the school level or the village level, how does that data travel up the chain. So if they had a better idea of how things work actually from the local government area up, they might be more conservative in their approach and more realistic. Yeah, realistic, I would say, not conservative. So it will be difficult, but that's the struggle. We really need to get some agreed indicators and to make sure that we don't have goals like goal 3. It's just provide appropriate skills and training. You know, how do you measure that? So, you know, all we use is enrollment in lower secondary schooling. That's practically all we can do. So, yeah, I don't know whether that answered the question, but commented on it anyway.
Good. Thank you. Okay. Ma bene.
Thank you so much for this presentation. And I can see you have worked very well in Nigeria, and I also happen to have done some work in Nigeria. I want to know your opinion on private schools and the quality of education, because in Nigeria there are so many private schools at every street, every corner. You see private schools, but it's hard to tell the criteria by which these private schools are established, whether the government is actually monitoring to know whether the extent to which they are following the syllabus and the quality of teachers that they are recruiting. I just want to know your view about that.
Actually, you've touched on the area that's closest to my heart, because that's my specialist area. So in Lagos, when I was finding all these schools in the lagoons, I was actually conducting the first census of private schools. The report is online. If you Google Lagos private school census, you'll find it. The private schools are growing up in so many areas, including India. That's where I started working on that and then went to Nigeria. I mean, they're really springing up as a result of all these government failures. So people think even though public school is nominally free, it's still so bad that they would rather pay some small fees. So, I mean, in Lagos state alone, they said that they thought that they had about 4,000 private schools, but I found 12,098. So they're operating illegally. They're totally unknown to the government. The government quality assurance body is completely out of its depth to even touch the idea of trying to quality assure or inspect these schools. Basically, the public provision just didn't keep pace, and now the population is so big that if the government tried to replace all these private schools with government provision, they would have to increase the public school system by over 100%. So now they're faced with the sort of de facto situation. There is a lot of argument on the quality. My studies didn't so much go into objectively assessing the quality. We were out to just confront the government with how many private schools there were and make them sit up and take notice of it and accept the reality. So that's why I was out finding all the schools and taking a census of how many pupils were attending them and everything. And then I did some studies on school choice. So parents very strongly believe that those schools are better, even though I've been in schools that were, you know, about the area of this corner and half flooded with lagoon water, so they were all crowded on this side. So it's the parents still think that that's better. They're usually closer to home. They operate more convenient hours for the parents, so they can go out and leave the child all day while they're at work, whereas government schools operate shorter periods. There's conflicting evidence on how, on the quality. A lot of people argue, and some studies show that in various contexts in India as well, that the better test scores are simply a result of more children from more motivated and slightly better off families together in one situation, so all the children are more motivated. But other studies seem to show that there is some private school advantage. You highlighted the teachers. They're usually young, you often totally untrained and quite poorly qualified. But a difference is that they're always there. Well, I shouldn't say that. They're not always there. They're there more than at the government school. They're with their class more than at the government school. So it seems like they may be doing marginally better. But one study, a very famous writer on this subject, James Tooley, he finds that, you know, there is an advantage. But when you look at it in the big scheme of things, it's like if you have zero here and 100 and the government's at like 20, so they're at like 30. They're not at 80 or something. So I think that's my view in a nutshell. But I've written a lot on this, so if you look for me on the net, you can find my writing on Nigeria as well.
Good. Thank you. I will give your last personal question. When you were handling with such huge masses of data gathered all over the globe, so what was there any such small piece of data or experience that you've had a feeling that, wow, this is nice? Do you have any example of that?
Like a positive example?
Like a positive, yeah. Exactly.
Oh, no. Well, one positive thing, okay, out of this private school census where I found the 12,098 schools, exactly 50% girls.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's a positive thing.
Yeah. That sounds fair.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's good. Thank you very much once more, Joanna, for this presentation, and look for her publications in the net. Visit the report website, and we will have a couple of copies also here. One more applause for Joanna. Thank you. And I forgot to introduce myself because I don't know everybody. So I'm Matti Kuorelahti, and I'm coming from the Department of Education, from the Faculty of Education with Maria-Leena Laakso, Professor Laakso. So the program for the afternoon is that we were quite clever. We will give you coffee and something to eat only at the end of this seminar. So we guarantee that you will not leave us too early. So now we are going straight to another topics, and we will be looking maybe more for teachers for a while. And we start from Professor Heikki Lyytinen, a well-known scholar in dyslexia research and an activist in both rehabilitation and studying. And he's behind the Niilo Mäki Institute together with Dr. Onerva Mäki. So Heikki, welcome. I'll give you this so that you can... You will be heard.
So, I'm very happy being able to tell you a little bit about our our work in this area of literacy teaching or helping children to learn to read. This is something which is apparently a very important area and very widely needed. So there are many reasons why many children fail or at least face great difficulties in learning to read. Biological reasons in countries like in Finland, and then basically educational insufficient instruction in developing world. And in some countries, as we learned, this portion of children who is not getting sufficient instruction is very, very high. So we have developed during 10 or so years technology which might provide a way to go. This is all based on very intensive studies of dyslexia. We followed children from birth to puberty who had a familial background of reading disorder, meaning that big portion of those children who were born to this type of families where one parent is dyslexic ended up facing difficulties in learning to read. And now we learned this way from very start, from birth on, all the developmental features which are associated to this type of difficulty, and also we had to learn what are the bottlenecks which had to be overcome to help those children to learn to read. And the very same techniques which are helping them to overcome the problems are helping any child who is wanting to learn to read. So how it has been made is that we have implemented a simple learning game to devices like mobile phones, tablets, computers. It can work also in very cheap device, very cheap mobile phones, for example. And how it goes is that children are given an opportunity to use this game, and if it is used in most optimal way, it is sometimes, not necessarily all the time, sometimes connected to our server, which provides complete feedback and guidelines how to go on. It is able to adapt to the individual needs at any moment of learning. So when people are speaking in US about response to intervention type of approach, this is not doing as they do there, that if child is found to have problems in one semester, then he or she will be helped in the next semester. It's absolutely too slow rate. This is helping such a child during the next second. So when this device finds a difficulty in differentiating certain phonemes from each other to be, so that the child would be able to connect them to letters, it is immediately going to train this perceptual difficulty in such a way that the differentiation is soon possible. And of course, when we have had an opportunity to implement this in Finland due to state procurement, we have huge amount of data which has been used for analyzing how it all can be made most optimally. And this has motivated quite a number of researchers from all of these universities to join us. And so we have a very, strong engine to help us working in developing world where, of course, the needs are most wide. One way to go, which has been supported from the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, Finland, is this, that we are developing centers in countries which need this type of help, where the local people are trained to use this technology and help children, like this center which we have in Lusaka in the context of the University of Zambia. So how we go is to have all those children who are learning to read to have an opportunity to be trained in the language they speak, because it is not possible to learn to read without using the language one is able to speak, because one has to know the sounds. Sounds are connected to letters. If the sounds are not there, it's absolutely not possible to learn to read. So in introducing English to children who have not been exposed to English fails for sure. So, and this has been done in so many countries, and everywhere it has failed. So children have to be instructed first to the spoken language, and then they can learn to read this spoken language. And of course it's most nice if they can be instructed to read the language they speak naturally in their own environment, and which is their everyday language. And this is what we are doing with our linguists and the people who are knowing the local languages in each country, so that we have the implementation made accurately to follow the sounds of the language. So we have how it works, how this type of enterprise in these African countries works, like this Kapolsa Center. We have been very lucky to have a very well informed professor level person to be working as the head of this unit. He made a big literacy related studies in US and UK before coming to Zambia, where he worked as a vice chancellor before. And then we have started training local students, and several of them are close to being able to defend their thesis nowadays. So we are like building this type of model example in Zambia, where the needs are most highest, as we learned from one of these slides showing that the literacy situation is lowest in Africa, in Zambia. And then we, of course, want to support them to go to other countries, like we have people working in the same area in Kenya, Namibia and Tanzania, where the same logic is used. So we are helping local students to make these empirical studies for their PhD work in these countries, and this way learn how to use it optimally, this technology optimally, and then guide its later usage in the country. The basic goal is to have it to go following the Finnish model. In Finland, we made a state procurement with the Ministry of Education, and the very same is tried in Africa, of course taking into account that we have to find the money for these implementations. And this, of course, is as big challenge as having everything made empirically shown first. So what these type of centers have to do is to just prepare people there to understand that this might be a way and an efficient way to have all first graders to learn to read. Today in Zambia, practically none third grader reads. So at the end of third grade, practically none reads. But we believe that having this made optimally, we could help all the children in Zambia, at least in these areas where they have electricity available, to be able to learn to read during the first grade. And the technology is developing fast, so it looks like the solar cells are coming to help us, so that we will be able to use these devices also in such countryside areas where electricity is not available without something new like solar cells. And this just summarizes the very same thing I already mentioned, that in Zambia the situation is extremely poor, and we have this. This is the reason why we have concentrated in making our studies first there. We have been working there for long, so we know a little bit the culture there, and it has helped us to make these empirical studies, which are now one study has been published internationally, a second one is coming very soon, and further studies are coming later. So immediately we have convincing background, which has been published in demanding scientific forums, showing that this implementation we have built for Zambian children is really efficiently helping them. We can go on and start collecting this money which is needed for letting the country to have this opportunity. And the Ministry of Education in Zambia has shown expressed interest in this signing this type of paper, meaning that they are ready to go. This shows where all countries we have had people, research groups, studying the efficiency. So now we are only in the beginning, a first step in Asia. But of course, we know that there are many universities there are very efficient. So we believe that having this collaboration with the best universities like of China, we probably will be able to move quite fast. And you can understand that the challenges there are much higher. The first step in China is learning Pinyin, which means connection between written symbol and sound. And later on, they of course need to go to learn the connection between written symbol and meaning, and huge number of connections. In Finnish language and African languages, the number of connections the child has to learn is about 30 or less. And when they have learned the sounds of 30 letters and invented that just putting these sounds in the order of the letters one is reading, it is a very easy task in this so-called transparent alphabetic writing environments. And it's also a relatively easy task to take the first step in China or in Asian writing systems, but the next step is much, much more difficult. And it is also quite difficult to learn to read English because none of the letters has always the same sound. It means that the unit which has to be connected is should be much larger, and the number of connections is maybe 2,000 or something like this, which is much higher than in these more regular transparent writing environments. So this is how we go, and if you are interested in learning more, you can go to graphogame.com or Graphogame Info page and find everything there. What is important is that we have this collaboration built with these top universities on the basis of a declaration, which declaration is signed by them and tells that they are happy to help us if we follow this guideline that everything is empirically proven before we go to have this game to be used, and second thing, it should be free to the end user. And this is why we have a big challenge to collect this money for being able to do that. And you all are needed to help me and us in this issue. But we are quite optimistic that we will end up being able to convince those who are able to collect the money for this purpose, and we can proceed and have all African children to learn to read. Maybe not during my lifetime, but during my followers' lifetime. Thank you very much.
Kiitoksia. Thank you. So a brief question, comment is allowed now if there is some urgent. Okay, Maija, please.
Okay, thank you. Have you tried or are you going to try to implement this game, Graphogame, for adults or for second chance students or pupils for dropouts. So what I'm asking is if there is like a vulnerability, difficult word to say, to learn to read, or is it perhaps a possibility for children or young people or even adults for in later years to learn to read?
Yeah, this is a question I have heard several times earlier. The problem is that adults tend not to be so interested in gaming. And the only way we have had some success in this type of approach has been when we have tried to have mother-child pairs to work, where the child is playing and very interested in playing and is like able to motivate the mother to do the same thing and help her, or maybe the child is helping the mother. But we have no data yet to go to any systematic studies associated to adults. But those studies which are connected to people who are moving from other countries to Finland, immigrants, have shown that at least in many cases some adults have at least tried that, but we have not collected empirical evidence whether it has really helped them.
Good. Thank you. Oh, I said that you will get the coffee only at 3:30 or something like that, but you will have a bio break now. So it means like 5 to 10 minutes, and then we will continue with Dr. Olli-Pekka. So please have a little walk around.